another execution video from ISIS today, Tuesday, September 2nd. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A new online video appears to show the beheading of journalist Stephen Sotloff by the militant group calling itself the Islamic State, or ISIS. One of Sotloff's colleagues vows to continue his work.
We cannot give in to ISIS and allow them to instill this fear into us so that we can't go to Syria and report on the suffering of the civilians, which is what Stephen was doing. This is what they want. If we let them do this, they've won.
We'll have the latest. Also today, tensions rise between Russia and NATO. A former U.S. ambassador to NATO says this is serious.
I think this is a fundamental challenge to the European security order that we haven't seen in a quarter century.
All that after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The militant group that calls itself the Islamic State decided to send another gruesome message to the United States today. It's an online video titled A Second Message to America, and it appears to show the beheading of American journalist Stephen Sotloff. The group, also known as ISIS, had threatened to kill Sotloff in its previous video, the one that showed James Foley's execution last month. We're going to hear from one of Sotloff's colleagues in a few minutes. First, though, we turn to Seth Jones, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. I asked him for his reaction earlier.
Well, this continues a cycle we've seen with ISIS and its predecessor groups, including al-Qaeda in Iraq, where they have periodically entered these phases where they have conducted beheadings of foreigners and then faced pretty vicious backlashes. And we're right now in a cycle where they seem to believe that it's in their interest to conduct these fairly gruesome beheadings and cover them on video.
So when was this video actually posted?
I first heard about it earlier today. I don't know the authenticity of when it was actually posted, and I can't confirm. I've watched it. I can't confirm that it's true. It looks pretty real.
You've seen it. What do we see, and what do we hear in it?
Well, we see somebody with a sharp knife clad in black that beheads a what appears to be Stephen Joel Sotloff, who's 31, in sort of an orange jumpsuit in a desert kind of environment.
Stephen Sotloff is speaking in it, right?
Stephen Sotloff is speaking in it at one point. The version I've seen has him garbled a little bit, but obviously it's a horrific video, and frankly is reminiscent of the kinds of videos we saw engineered by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in the 2003-2004 period in Iraq of a number of individuals.
Can you tell where it was recorded? I mean, does it appear to be that same desert landscape that was in the background in the James Foley video?
Hard to say. It's a little easier with some geospatial imaging to identify it, but hard to eyeball the location. I mean, it could be various areas either in Syria or Iraq.
And what are the actual steps in analyzing the veracity of this video? I mean, generally in cases like this.
There are a couple things that one would do. One is, first of all, identify the victim in this case and to get people who knew him to identify that indeed was him, including family members. Second would be to try to identify the area where this was done. And there are a range of computer packages that can help identify landscape patterns. And then in addition, I think with any government agency, efforts to intercept communications by, in this case, ISIS, talking about it, emailing about it to help confirm, or even people that were connected to the organization, human sources, human intelligence sources that can confirm it. So as many kinds of confirmations as possible.
So what do you think the next step from the U.S. government is going to be?
Well, it's hard to know. What is a little concerning is that ISIS has multiple other captives, including Americans. You know, there may be efforts to try and encourage ISIS to not execute these individuals. I don't think the United States is going to be in the position of wanting to negotiate for the release of any of these individuals, but it's possible with other Western governments that they may. The French, for example, have negotiated for the release of hostages in parts of North Africa. But I think the second thing is this may also harden the U.S. government's interest in continuing to perceive ISIS as a major threat to the U.S. and actually encourage it to increase its strike portfolio and its package against ISIS, especially in Iraq.
Seth Jones with the RAND Corporation, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
My BBC colleague Paul Danahar in Washington is the author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. He also gave me his reaction to the news about Stephen Sotloff earlier today.
It's just incredibly depressing news. I think people feared the worst when they saw him appear at the end of the video in which James Foley was killed. There was very little chance that the plea for mercy from Mr. Sotloff's family would be listened to. ISIS have shown no mercy to anyone they've come across so far. I guess really many people were expecting that eventually this would happen. It was a matter really just of when.
Yeah, where does this now kind of resituate the whole war in Syria and Iraq?
Well, we now don't have a war in Syria and Iraq. We have one war. This war basically is in the area that ISIS, or the Islamic State, as they've now renamed themselves, control. They say they are creating an Islamic State. The border, to all intents and purposes, between Syria and Iraq has disappeared. And so we now have a situation where we have one war in the Middle East, and that war is across two countries. It's with an organization that has managed to capture many, many advanced bits of military from the Iraq, which was originally given to them by the Americans. We have a situation where America, as the president said last week, does not have a policy for ISIS in Syria. And if you don't have a policy in Syria, you can't really have a policy in Iraq because this is one war and one organization. And I think what we've got now is basically the international community trying to play catch up, because everyone was warning that this is what would happen if a vacuum was created in Syria to allow the most extreme jihadi groups to basically pull themselves together, having been routed from Afghanistan, and to create a new terrorist stronghold, and that is in Syria and Iraq. And now we're just seeing the consequences of that.
Well, ISIS presented the White House with an ultimatum, stop bombing northern Iraq or we're going to kill another journalist. So is this going to engage the Obama administration in terms of foreign policy, do you think?
Well, I think what it has clearly done, and we've seen the missile attacks that have taken place since Mr. Foley was killed, it's very much focused the president's mind on ISIS. You remember that back in January, he was joking there was some kind of junior varsity team. I think the problem is that the president didn't take them seriously when many people said that he should. And now he is having to take them seriously because they are killing Americans on television. It will change the policy, but will it stop them carrying out actions against this group? No, because they know that ISIS is going to carry on murdering people as the way they have been. It may not be Americans. There is now the end of this video showing Mr. Sotloff. ISIS talks about murdering a British hostage. This is not an organization that you can negotiate with. We're basically now talking about the need to destroy them, because they cannot in any way be blunted. They have massive amounts of artillery. They have many, many thousands of men. They need to be defeated ideologically and militarily.
What are the big questions you have on your mind right now about what the implications are of an episode like this for the whole region?
Well, there's a couple of things. I think one thing we really have to worry about is the fact that we now have a magnet for every would-be jihadi, any disillusioned young man that's trying to find a purpose in life. In the same way we had in Yugoslavia during the war there, in the same way we had in Chechnya, we had it in Afghanistan, we now have a great big melting pot for people that are looking for a cause that they're willing to fight and murder and die for. And what we've seen now in the middle of the Middle East, in the middle of the most fractious part of the Middle East, somewhere that you can go and join a group and carry out the worst atrocities and almost do it without anyone stopping you. It's such a big area now. The borders are so porous. There seems to be no way to stop this flow. And the more that ISIS carries out these kind of high-profile murders, the more publicity they get, the more they will attract not only people from outside, Europeans and Americans, but if you live in the Middle East and you have to think about the security of your own family, you will join the side that you think can best protect them. And what we've seen in Iraq is many, many Sunni Muslims who probably don't actually agree with the ideology of ISIS, but they're joining them to stay alive.
Paul Danahar, the BBC's Washington bureau chief. We also reached out today to Janine DiGiovanni. She's Middle East editor at Newsweek, based in Paris, and a friend and colleague of Stephen Sotloff's.
I'm just horrified. I'm horrified and I'm angry, and I'm extremely concerned for the future of our profession and how we carry on. And also grieving for the people of Syria and Iraq who don't get the kind of coverage that we reporters get, but who are also dying and suffering and terrified.
How did you know Stephen Sotloff? What was the connection?
I met him in Syria. I don't want to say when or how, but we were in touch right up until he was abducted. He was a very bright guy and incredibly smart, quick. He had lived in Yemen. He spoke the language. He had a traveling buddy. And the two of them were just very sharp, very fast. And I had a lot of respect for him. He was young, but he was very dedicated. He lived in Benghazi, which I think I've mentioned on this show before, is a real sign of dedication for a journalist to dig into a place like that. It's one thing to live in Istanbul. It's one thing to live in Paris, where I do, but it really shows true dedication to go live in Benghazi and try to report a story from the inside like that. And I think that says a lot about his character.
Not to mention going to Syria and covering the war there.
Not to mention going to Syria. And one of the last messages I had from him was that he was very concerned that there had been a list of journalists who were being targeted or were being considered. And I have a very kind of striking email that he sent to me, which basically said, we're all naive when we think about how we feel like we're never going to die. And, you know, over the past 20 years, I've lost so many colleagues now and so many close friends who felt the same way, just never felt that that bullet or that that mortar or that sniper, or in this case, that he'd be kidnapped, that he would die in such a horrific way. None of us ever think like that. I suppose if we did think like that, there's no way that we'd be able to do this job.
And yet you expressed a moment ago concern about what this will do to reporting in Syria.
Well, my greatest concern right now, and I actually think we must have some kind of dialogue about this, is how do we continue to report it? Because we have to. We absolutely have to. We cannot give in to ISIS and allow them to instill this fear into us so that we can't go to Syria and report on the suffering of the civilians, which is what Stephen was doing. This is what they want. And if we let them do this, they've won.
Janine, you know Stephen Sotloff's family. Have you spoken with any of them?
I haven't. I'm going to write to his mother. I saw her her plea to ISIS. And, you know, I'm a mother. I have a son. And I could not put myself in her shoes or in the shoes of Jim Foley's family, who have responded with such incredible dignity and courage and chose love over hate. I don't know if I'd be a good enough person to do that if it was a family member of mine. I think that these are terrible, dark times. And I think that as a community of journalists, of reporters, we have to band together and we have to come to some kind of consensus about how we can continue to cover Syria. We can't abandon it. And that's something that I think Jim Foley and Steve would not have wanted. They were both deeply, deeply committed to this story.
Janine, thanks for your time and your thoughts.
Thank you very much.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. With so much mayhem around the globe these days, it's hard to know where to look first. But right now, we're going to turn our gaze to Ukraine. The country has been a tinderbox since Moscow annexed a part of Ukrainian territory in March. Now, NATO may be edging closer to full-fledged war with Russia. Ivo Dalder, the former U.S. ambassador to NATO, sees a grim scenario ahead.
It's the most serious crisis since the end of the Cold War. Now we have to think about security, not just in economic and political terms, but in military terms. And that is something an entire generation of Europeans has never experienced.
Europeans won't be the only ones watching closely this week when NATO leaders meet in Wales. The NATO brass are expected to endorse a rapid reaction force that could send some 4,000 troops to Eastern Europe on 48 hours' notice. Dalder says that will catch the attention of Russian President Vladimir Putin.
The real message here to Moscow is whatever you may be doing in Ukraine, don't even think about what is possible for doing in the Baltic states or Poland or Romania. They are NATO members. They are members who have had the security commitment of the United States, of every other NATO country, to defend them. To see an attack on them is an attack on ourselves. And this force is just one part of a much larger readiness package designed to both reassure the European allies in the East and, importantly, deter and send a real message to Vladimir Putin in the West that when it comes to NATO and the defense of NATO territory, there is no question but that that defense will happen, and anybody who tries to challenge it will pay a dear, dear price.
What else is in that package that may be even more forceful than a rapid reaction force, or is that the biggest muscle?
It's the biggest muscle in the first 48 hours, but the Brits will announce a larger force of about 14,000 troops consisting not only of UK, but also Dutch and Danish and Norwegian and perhaps Canadian forces to provide for reinforcement. The United States has committed to exercising and reinforcing on a rotating basis forces from the United States into Europe in order to demonstrate the capacity to provide defense of all of NATO territory. There will be expenditures on infrastructure so that air bases can be able to have large numbers of aircraft come in, ports can have large numbers of ships providing troops and equipment. All of that is designed to provide a real capable defense of all of NATO territory.
Yeah, that's a lot more than those 4,000 rapid reaction force troops. One could argue that putting together all of these forces, that could escalate tensions even further.
One could argue that, but what is happening here is that the first move and the second move and the third move have all come from Moscow. It is Moscow that annexed a part of Ukrainian territory in March in terms of the Crimea. It is Moscow that has instigated and supported the separatist forces in eastern Ukraine, and it is now Moscow that has invaded, because that's the only word you can use, with troops, tanks, and armored personnel carriers and artillery, a neighboring state. Under those conditions, it is necessary, it is indeed imperative, that the NATO countries, at the very least, sent the message that whatever you have in mind, don't even think about coming to NATO territory.
Putin might be in a situation where he can't step back without losing face. Is that a concern?
It is a concern in the sense that what we want is the reestablishment of the status quo ante. And it is in his power to do that, because he's the one who's upset the status quo. We all want a negotiated and political solution, but that won't happen until three conditions are met. Russia stops its support of separatist forces, both in terms of sending people and material over the border, that Russia withdraw all its military forces that are now inside Ukraine back into Russia, and Russia recognizes the territorial independence of Ukraine, which is actually pretty fundamental to the security order that we see. But until that happens, until the invasion is ended, until the overt and covert support to separatist forces is ended, there really isn't a hell of a lot to talk about.
Why is Vladimir Putin being so openly confrontational right now? Is he picking a fight with NATO, do you think?
I think he is trying to demonstrate that he is the big guy in town, that he is the one who can control the future of Ukraine. He was surprised, frankly, when the Ukrainian people took matters in their own hands, when they for months protested in Kiev against the decision by their president to reject a trade agreement with the European Union and instead to put his fate in Russia's hands. He was surprised that President Yanukovych stood down in February and has been surprised ever since. So he is now trying to reestablish control of Russia over Ukraine's fate.
So what would you say, if you had to sum it up, what is Vladimir Putin's worldview? I mean, do you think he ever had any intention of being a NATO ally?
No, I don't. I think Vladimir Putin's worldview is a zero-sum worldview. I think he said it himself best back in the middle of the last decade, in 2005, when he said that the greatest geostrategic catastrophe of the 20th century was the breakup of the Soviet Union. And I think he's dedicated to reestablishing, if not de jure, the Soviet Union, de facto, the control of Russia over its immediate neighbors.
Do you think Putin is looking at a White House dealing with multiple foreign policy crises, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Gaza, and just thinking, they're distracted, I can get away with this?
I think Putin is looking at the world and says, my interest in controlling Ukraine is larger than the European or indeed the American interest in preventing that from happening. I think he's miscalculating. He will see that that may be true when it comes to the use of military force. It is true that the United States and the European allies aren't willing to defend Ukraine directly with their own troops, but they are willing to isolate Russia politically and to place ever-increasing sanctions on it economically.
I mean, the military option just seems more and more present right now. I'm curious, though, as far as diplomatic options, what's your own experience dealing with Russian officials? And are we also facing just plain old complex practical diplomacy on the ground?
What we're seeing now, which I think we haven't seen for some time, is blatant lying, which makes diplomacy very difficult. When the person sitting across of you is telling things that you know to be true and that you know that he knows not to be true, then the basis for negotiations, the basis for trust is removed. The idea that Russia continues even to this day to deny that Russian troops are in Ukraine is risible. We have all the evidence necessary. NATO has released evidence directly of the fact that Russian troops and Russian equipment are in Ukraine. And under those circumstances, conducting diplomacy, which in the end has to be based on some form of trust, is not only difficult, it is impossible.
Ambassador Daldor, I have to say you sound a little rattled by all of this. How bad are things?
I'm not rattled, but I think we need to be very realistic. I don't think this is just a crisis that through negotiations we can resolve. I think this is a fundamental challenge to the European security order that we haven't seen in a quarter century. And that's why I think the NATO summit this week is such a defining moment. It's a time for NATO to step up and say, we are here to defend not only the territory of NATO, but that very security order that Putin is now challenging. It will require not an immediate solution, but a long-term strategy that makes the costs to Russia so high that a change in policy becomes inevitable.
Ivo Daldor, former U.S. ambassador to NATO, now head at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Coming up, a veteran photojournalist returns home after years overseas and finds that taking pictures here is just as interesting as in North Korea, Afghanistan, or wherever. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, Libya's uncertain post-revolutionary reality.
We see two parallel governments, two parallel authorities, completely independent of each other, and they don't want to cooperate with each other. But there are no geographical boundaries, and people who support each of those authorities are mixed in geographically with the other.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
You're tuned to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, reeling from the news this afternoon about the apparent killing of American journalist Stephen Sotloff. The militant group ISIS again posted an execution video just as it did with James Foley last month. Both journalists had been held hostage by ISIS in Syria. It's a tragic reminder of how an unfinished revolution like Syria's can provide an opening to militants. Another place where that could be the case is Libya. The crisis there deepened after a powerful militia opposed to the government took control of the capital's airport a week ago. Here's more on that from Marine Olivesi in Tripoli.
This is what it sounds like inside Tripoli's airport. No departure calls, no harried passengers, just the crackling noise of what's left of the building. Charred rubble, broken glass, and metal rails. After 5 weeks of clashes, the main terminal looks like an apocalyptic movie set. The fighting is between rival militias from the western cities of Misrata and Zintan, two armed groups that worked together to defeat Muammar Gaddafi's forces here 3 years ago. Abdul Basset, her Homa, lives a few streets away from the airport. His four daughters are digging up large caliber bullet casings from their sandy backyard. No major damage to their home, but the battle has cost Abdul Basset his job. He's worked at the airport for 14 years. He says it's sad to see it in shambles, but he supports the Misrati fighters. Their goal was to free the airport from the Zintani brigades, which have been accused of smuggling weapons and drugs through the facility since they took over in 2011. Abdul Basset can't confirm any of that, but he says it certainly wasn't run as a proper civilian airport.
In a few occasions, we've had passengers coming on into the airport hoping to catch a flight somewhere, and for whatever reason, they would be dragged into interrogation rooms and threatened with weapons and so on by the militia controlling the airport, and just things like that really was the worst of it.
The Misrati fighters didn't just stop at the airport. They overran rival militias' bases and set up checkpoints across the city. It marked the first time since the revolution that Libya's capital fell under the control of a single armed group. The calm of one ruling force might be a relief for some, but residents like Salah Kikli say there's no reason to celebrate.
You know, they keep saying, oh, we've liberated you. You know, they've said it before and they're saying it again. And what we don't understand is what exactly they're liberating us from. You know, they're liberating us from Zintan. Well, Zintan weren't as bad as them. I mean, yes, Zintan, they'd steal your car. And yeah, sure, every now and again they kidnapped some people, but it was nowhere near as bad as what Misrata do.
Salah says he's bracing for worse now that they're back in full force and without any counterbalancing powers left in Tripoli. Politically, the takeover also disrupts the fragile democratic transition in the country. Misrata militias aren't just claiming to protect the capital. They're also trying to reinstate Libya's previous Congress, which was dominated by mainstream Islamic forces that lost parliament elections in June. Peter Dollarmore is an operations manager for Salamanca Group, a risk consultancy company. He says both sides are irrationally convinced of their claims to legitimacy.
What's developing in Libya is a fairly unique situation and perhaps without historical precedent, where we see two parallel governments, two parallel authorities growing up completely independent of each other and completely ignorant of each other, and they don't want to cooperate with each other. But there are no geographical boundaries, and people who support each of those authorities are mixed in geographically with the other.
Libya's House of Representatives, exiled in a town near the Egyptian border, has asked the international community to help them crack down on opposing militias. Salah, for one, says he's lost faith in a peaceful resolution between pro- and anti-Islamist and their respective armed forces. He fought during the revolution with both Misratis and Zintanis, but none of that matters anymore, he says. Power-hungry militias took away his voice.
I assure you that anybody who speaks out in any way, the second they're heard, you'll have one of the patrols from whatever militia you accused of doing something wrong, if not both, in front of your house coming to arrest you. There is no getting away from it, you know, apart from literally getting away from the country.
Salah is making plans to leave Libya in the coming weeks with his daughter and pregnant wife. The streets of Tripoli might be quiet again, but it's far from peaceful. And he says he doesn't want to stick around until the next battle. For The World, I'm Marine Olivesi in Tripoli, Libya.
For the past 20 years, David Gutenfelder has traversed the world, mostly as a photojournalist for the Associated Press. He's covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Middle East, even gone to North Korea. In fact, he set up the AP's bureau in Pyongyang, North Korea, a first for a Western news organization. I first noticed Gutenfelder through his Instagram photos from North Korea. They were seemingly small glimpses of everyday life in the isolated communist nation, but they conveyed so much more. Now, after 2 decades away from home, David Gutenfelder says he's turning his lens on the U.S.
I'm using the same tools, I'm using the same process to photograph my own country, to work as a sort of cultural anthropologist in my own country. What are the things that are ubiquitous in our own culture? What are the things that strike me on the surface when I come back here that say a lot about American culture? So, you know, black cat firecrackers or the ice bucket at the Super 8 Motel. These are things that I remember growing up in the United States and that say something, I think, kind of funny or reveal something unique about America.
What about the reaction from people to you're taking pictures of these funny little banal things? I mean, like, did you ever have North Koreans saying, why are you taking that picture of that bag of dried fish? And do they do the same here?
Yeah, actually, in North Korea, I remember going, we toured a dentist's office and I purchased a North Korean-made travel toothbrush because I thought it was so kind of quaint and funny and actually very useful. So I bought it and then I was photographing it and I think they were very confused. I bought a roll of North Korean toilet paper that didn't have a hole in the middle, actually. I kind of privately photographed it because I thought they're going to think that I'm, you know, bizarre photographing a roll of toilet paper. And yeah, I'm doing the same here. I'm photographing the ice bucket or the Gideon Bible in
right.
my hotel.
And are Americans in the Midwest asking you, you know, at the fair, why are you taking a picture of that corn dog?
Yeah, actually, I placed the corn dog on a picnic table and there was a guy sitting there and I asked him if I could place my foot-long corn dog in the middle of his table and take a picture of it. He didn't ask me directly, but he looked at me like I was insane.
Well, you just grab these kind of seemingly mundane moments, like the picture of the butcher with the powerful biceps and his T-shirt with that giant pig face on it. I just keep staring at it. It's just gorgeous. There's something there.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, our America. People started asking in the comment feed after that picture, you know, where did you get that shirt? Who is this guy? And then his daughter came on. That's my dad. And then the subject in the picture wrote to me and sent me a long email thanking me, saying that he really liked the image. And so it's really fun and interesting way of creating community.
In addition to your real cameras and your own Instagram account, you've started a new Instagram account called @EverydayUSA. What's that about? What's the goal?
I got the idea for the name because there's a photographer named Peter DeCampo. He started an Instagram account called Everyday Africa. Mm-hmm. And his intention with Everyday Africa was to create an Instagram feed where African photographers could tell their own story. And it was a very powerful way to subvert stereotypes about Africa. And while I was in North Korea, I was looking at that and I registered the name Everyday DPRK, Everyday North Korea. And then mm-hmm. I registered Everyday USA. And when I came back to the United States in July, actually the 4th of July, I thought this is the right time to launch it. And I gathered together 12 people who I thought were really interesting and we put it out there.
So take us back to your pictures. Just a final question for you, David. What is your favorite photo from the series so far that you've been photographing out in the Midwest?
My favorite photo from the series, I suppose, was probably one of the first ones I took, which was at my sister's house. My sister lives on a small farm in rural Iowa, not far from where I grew up, and they had a 4th of July party, and they built a water slide out of straw and plastic bags and I don't know how many lengths of garden hose at the base of their barn leading down the hill and into the valley.
That's incredible.
And that was the week that I moved back to the United States, and it was exactly 20 years from the week that I moved off and tried to be a freelance photographer in Africa and the Middle East. So, yeah, my first picture from Everyday USA was my niece at my sister's farm.
Did you try the slide?
I didn't try the slide. Yeah, I usually hide behind the camera.
National Geographic photographer David Guttenfelder back in the United States after working abroad for 20 years. He started the Instagram project @EverydayUSA. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've pulled together a selection of our favorites from David Guttenfelder's Instagram projects. You can see those photos at PRI.org. If you're listening to me right now in Scotland, I guess it's too late. Today was the deadline to register to vote in the Scottish independence referendum. On September 18th, the 4 million plus residents of Scotland will decide whether to remain in the United Kingdom, along with England, Wales, and Northern Ireland, or go it alone. Scots living outside of Scotland don't get to vote. And as you might imagine, many Scottish expats are not happy about that. Our colleague here at WGBH Boston, Elizabeth Ross, has our story.
Sing me a song of a lass that is gone.
This summer, viewers of the network Stars saw the debut of the stunning series Outlander. The series follows the story of a World War II English combat nurse called Claire. She's mysteriously whisked back in time to the 18th century Scottish Highlands, where she meets the dashing young warrior Jamie, who's part of a clan fighting against the Scottish Union with England.
Just never forget that you're English in a place where that's not a pretty thing to be.
Now, fast forward to the 21st century and the very real drama of tensions between England and Scotland. This time, it's a battle that pits the Scottish government against the British one. It's peaceful, no shots have been fired, but believe me, just like Outlander, it's passionate. And it comes down to this. Is Scotland willing to break its union with England that's lasted more than 300 years?
On AM and FM around the UK, on digital and online, I'm Rod Sharp, and we're up all night.
Rod Sharp is the long-serving host of the BBC show Up All Night on Radio 5 Live.
This vote here is a bigger deal in constitutional terms, probably than anything that's happened in Scotland since 1707, which was the time of the union of the parliaments.
Follow me.
Sharp's originally from Scotland, but these days he presents his radio show out of his home in Marblehead, Massachusetts. It's a town familiar with struggles for independence during the American Revolution.
Very many arrangements have to be reconsidered. The currency union has to be renegotiated. The union with the rest of Europe, the European Union, has to be renegotiated.
Sharp has accepted that he won't have a say in Scotland's independence decision, but he's ticked off that the referendum will force people to choose between being Scottish or British. He says it's the ability to be both that makes things interesting.
On the one hand, kind of wanting to be invited to a garden party with the Queen, and on the other hand, being fiercely proud of the fact that we beat the hell out of the English in 1314 and continue to do so whenever the opportunity arises in rugby at Murrayfield every 20 years or so.
So I would vote for an independent Scotland.
John McIlwain grew up in Glasgow. He now lives in the Boston suburb of Newton and works for a software company. McIlwain thinks a vote for independence will give the Scottish Parliament, rather than the British one, the power to make important decisions for his country. But there's something about the referendum that McIlwain finds galling. The vote is open to some people living in Scotland who aren't Scots, while more than a million Scottish expats, even those living in the rest of the UK, can't participate.
I can't vote on self-determination of Scotland, which is where I was born. It's where I spend time every year. I own property and I still spend quite a bit of money. So it's disappointing for me that you know, I can't vote, especially since, you know, if you're English and you live in Scotland for a short amount of time, you can vote.
William Bowery teaches English and theatre at the British International School of Boston.
It's disappointing, but it ultimately was my choice not to live in Scotland.
Without a vote, Bowery has taken his strong arguments against independence to social media. His chief concern? Scotland's economy.
My fear is of the unknown, in terms of the fact that I'm not quite sure what will happen financially and fiscally in an independent Scotland. It's all very well waving kilts, you know, across the Highlands, but when it comes to the question of are you going to receive the same pension rate, I think that's what people will ultimately vote on.
Like any good drama, this one isn't over. You'll need to tune in again on September 18th to find out what ultimately happens. For The World, I'm Elizabeth Ross in Boston.
The end of summer means most kids are back in school across the country, this country that is, a relief for some parents, mixed emotions for others. Mixed emotions of a different sort in other places around the world where school's back in session or should be back in session, like in the Middle East, where a ceasefire in Gaza doesn't mean everything's back to normal for students. Israeli kids living near the Gaza border are still nervous about walking to school after spending much of their summer in and out of bomb shelters. Then again, in Gaza, the start of the school has been delayed because so many Gazans are still sheltering in schools after their homes were destroyed in the fighting with Israel. In Liberia, it's the Ebola crisis that's keeping kids from school, while in Ukraine, schools reopened yesterday, except in battle-ridden parts of eastern Ukraine. And finally, I have to mention the 30,000-some-odd students from China who are starting their new school year now right here in the U.S. That's thanks to growing spending by China's middle class. All right, time for recess. You're listening to The World on PRI Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Abortion is never an easy topic, no matter where you live. Just look at the American debate over laws like the one in Louisiana, requiring that doctors who perform abortions have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. In Ethiopia, abortion remains a touchy subject, despite laws that liberalized access to abortion a few years ago. Dalia Murtada has more.
In Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, this multi-story clinic is where a lot of women come to get birth control advice, to give birth and follow up on their pregnancies, and sometimes to have abortions. It's where I meet 29-year-old Khadija Ali, a fake name she gave me, undergoing an abortion.
Are you in pain right now?
Not too much.
Not too much.
Wringing her hands, partly from anxiety, partly from the cramping caused by the abortion medicine, Khadija explains that she was raped in Bahrain, where she worked for a family. I left as soon as I found out I was pregnant, she says. Khadija says she's glad she can get the service, privately and safely. No one can ever know about the pregnancy or the abortion, especially not her husband. Ethiopia is a religious, conservative country. Khadija is Muslim. The majority of Ethiopians are Orthodox Christians. But a thing they share is that abortions are not okay.
Talking about the abortion law, I mean, this is something very sensitive in the community.
That's Addis Woldemariam, the Minister of Health's chief of staff.
People practice it, but they don't want to talk about it.
Before the new regulations in 2005, a third of all maternal deaths were from botched abortions. The law stopped short of fully legalizing abortion, but it did allow abortions in cases of rape, incest, birth defects, and if the girl is under 18 or her life is in danger. Woldemariam says the changes have been a godsend for Ethiopian women. But many, like Dr. Seyim Antonios, say that the new law has become a backhanded way to legalize abortion.
What I'm seeing is the interpretation by itself opened a floodgate for people to exploit the new penal code.
Antonios is a surgeon and leads a prominent Protestant pro-life group. He says the law's loopholes are enormous.
If a woman comes to you to a medical facility saying that she's raped, she's not expected to deliver any evidence of the rape. With regard to incest, the same thing. You cannot argue with her. If a woman of 35 comes to you and says, I'm 17, you have to write 17.
Many agree with Antonio's. Dr. Dawit Arga is a devout man himself. As we speak, he fiddles with a keychain that's got an image of the Virgin Mary. But he says, ultimately, it doesn't matter what God or religious men say. Doctors, even those who believe abortions are religiously forbidden, have a duty.
When you stay in the medical world and when you see complications that have happened because a trained physician didn't attend to the proper procedure, then you come to think that if you do the proper thing, you can save lives.
And he's in the business of saving lives, Arga says, something he believes God would approve of. For The World, I'm Dalia Murtada in Addis Ababa.
Dahlia's reporting in Ethiopia was possible thanks to a grant from the International Reporting Project. Finally today, we turn over the airwaves to Tamar Charney. She's program director at Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor. This summer, Tamar traveled to Iceland to take a road trip across the island nation. She had her tunes ready, a playlist packed with well-known Icelandic artists. But as we're about to hear, that's not what she ended up listening to.
I was so ready with my playlist for driving across Iceland. It was a binge of Björk, Sugar Cubes, and Sigur Rós. But when we got in our little rental car, it hit us. No MP3 jack. No jack, no playlist. No playlist, no road trip. That meant one thing, find an actual record store. And there it was, Lucky Records in Reykjavik. The guy at the counter sent us over to a wall of Icelandic CDs, near a big easy chair and a CD player. The first one I put on was Somber Air by some band named Epic Rain. Cool name, funky album art, but I figured it was just another wannabe band. Boy, was I wrong.
I turn my back to the city. I'm committed to the road. And the weight of the world is a heavy load. A bird under attack. Tiny chapels and small trees. The black sand goes forever. And cold is the ocean breeze.
The dark, cinematic, hip-hoppy dreamscapes made me want to hear more. I randomly picked one of their two albums to buy, got a few other Icelandic CDs, then I popped Epic Rain's Elegy into the car stereo. What unfolded was a perfect soundtrack to Iceland. Epic Rain reflected the imagery, the birds, horses, and stark beauty of the sea and sky. Their music also locked into the solitude and quiet I found in the emptiness of the land, and it even captured some of what our own inner landscapes might look like.
The road we travel never ends. We fall behind and curse the storm. Climbing trees we tear the sky till every single bird is gone. Rivers turn, fires burn, as I choose my line of work. Smiling clown, crying girl, all obsessed, tired world. Running fast, breaking laws, criminals and small-time thieves.
I wasn't expecting an Icelandic band to nail both what I was seeing as we toured the country and what my own daydreams and nightmares might sound like.
Making bed out of roses as the devil shovels.
I row my boat to no man's land, gently against the stream.
Within days of buying that one CD, I had downloaded their EP, Murder of Crows. When I got back home, I ordered their other album. I also watched their YouTube videos. Yup, beautifully weird. And I learned a bit more about the band. Johannes Palmerson, the lyricist and rapper of Epic Rain, is actually of Lebanese descent, not Icelandic. But in retrospect, that kind of fits. There's an outsider ethos to the words he writes.
I feel like my time is running out. Nothing left to talk about. Friends come and go. I'm digging up my past, knowing all the answers, too afraid to ask, though. I run slow, fall fast, solitary man on a lonely conquest. I try to keep my eyes on the road, fighting all these lies in my soul.
A trip isn't a trip without some kind of souvenir. Most people visiting Iceland come home with a toy puffin or a big wool sweater. I came home with something a bit more in keeping with the literal meaning of souvenir. A new favorite band that made me feel oddly connected to the country. You know, a vacation soundtrack that reminded me that the point of travel is to find yourself in the midst of the unfamiliar. And that sometimes you just have to turn it up.
I'm running out of days. I'm stuck on a sable island. My shoes need shining and the typewriter is silent. Strange rumbles.
Tamar Charney, program director at Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor. See her road trip snapshots and listen to some of her Epic Rain favorites at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
In a different place. Mine is always hiding behind my ruined face. I avoid mirrors. I'm lurking in the shadows. I walk alone, cause I got no one to follow. I fight a slow retreat. I blend into time. The calendar is upside down.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs. The Annenberg Foundation, advancing a better tomorrow through visionary leadership today. More at annenbergfoundation.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.